As Gorbachev explained why the United States must strongly support the policies of Yevgeny Primakov, the Russian prime minister who was fired not long afterward, row after row of eyes began to glaze. I counted at least half a dozen people seated near me in the grand ballroom who fell asleep during Gorbachev's speech. The executive right beside me suddenly awoke in the middle of a long anecdote about how the Mongol invasion had affected the Russian character in the Middle Ages. The executive seemed startled and unaware of his surroundings, then glanced at the podium for a moment, felt reassured, and drifted back to sleep, his chin resting flat on his chest. Gorbachev sounded like a politician from a distant era, from a time before soundbites. He was serious, long-winded, and sometimes difficult to follow. His mere presence at the Mirage was far more important to this crowd than anything he said. The meaning hit me as I looked around at all the fast food executives, the sea of pinstriped suits and silk ties. In ancient Rome, the leaders of conquered nations were put on display at the circus. The symbolism was unmistakable. The submission to Rome, complete. Gorbachev's appearance at the Mirage seemed an Americanized version of that custom, a public opportunity for the victors to gloat, though it would have been even more fitting if the fast food convention had been down the road at Caesar's Palace. As a Soviet leader, Mikhail Gorbachev never learned when to leave the stage, a flaw that led to his humiliating defeat in the campaign of 1996. He made the same mistake in Las Vegas. People got up and left the grand ballroom while he was still speaking. "Margaret Thatcher was a lot better," I heard one executive say to another as they headed for the door. Thatcher had addressed the previous year's chain operators exchange. The day after Gorbachev's speech at the Mirage, Bob Dylan performed at the grand opening of the new Mandalay Bay Casino. And billboards along the interstate announced that Peter Lowe's Success 1999 was coming to Las Vegas, with special appearances by Elizabeth Dole and General Colin Powell. For most of the 20th century, the Soviet Union stood as the greatest obstacle to the worldwide spread of American values and the American way of life. The collapse of Soviet communism has led to an unprecedented Americanization of the world, expressed in the growing popularity of movies, CDs, music videos, television shows, and clothing from the United States. Unlike those commodities, fast food is the one form of American culture that foreign consumers literally consume. By eating like Americans, people all over the world are beginning to look more like Americans, at least in one respect. The United States now has the highest obesity rate of any industrialized nation in the world. More than half of all American adults and about one quarter of all American children are now obese or overweight. Those proportions have soared during the last few decades, along with the consumption of fast food. The rate of obesity among American adults is twice as high today as it was in the early 1960s. The rate of obesity among American children is twice as high as it was in the late 1970s. According to James O. Hill, a prominent nutritionist at the University of Colorado, we've got the fattest, least fit generation of kids ever. The medical literature classifies a person as obese if he or she has a body mass index, BMI, of 30 or higher, a measurement that takes into account both weight and height. For example, a woman who is 5'5" and weighs 132 pounds has a BMI of 22, which is considered normal. If she gains 18 pounds, her BMI rises to 25, and she's considered overweight. If she gains 50 pounds, her BMI reaches 30, and she's considered obese. Today, about 44 million American adults are obese. An additional 6 million are super obese. They weigh about 100 pounds more than they should. No other nation in history has gotten so fat so fast. A recent study by half a dozen researchers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention found that the rate of American obesity was increasing in every state and among both sexes, regardless of age, race, or educational level. Although the current rise in obesity has a number of complex causes, genetics is not one of them. The American gene pool has not changed radically in the past few decades. What has changed is the nation's way of eating and living. In simple terms, when people eat more and move less, they get fat. In the United States, people have become increasingly sedentary, driving to work instead of walking, performing little manual labor, driving to do errands, watching television, playing video games, and using a computer instead of exercising. Budget cuts have eliminated physical education programs at many schools. And the growth of the fast food industry has made an abundance of high-fat, inexpensive meals widely available. As people eat more meals outside the home, they consume more calories, less fiber, and more fat. Commodity prices have fallen so low that the fast food industry has greatly increased its portion sizes without reducing profits in order to attract customers. The size of a burger has become one of its main selling points. Wendy's offers the Triple Decker, Burger King, the Great American, and Hardee's sells a hamburger called the Monster. The Little Caesars slogan, "Big, Big," now applies not just to the industry's portions, but to its customers. Over the past 40 years in the United States, per capita consumption of carbonated soft drinks has more than quadrupled. During the late 1950s, the typical soft drink order at a fast food restaurant contained about 8 ounces of soda. Today, a child order of Coke at McDonald's is 12 ounces. A large Coke is 32 ounces and about 310 calories. In 1972, McDonald's added large French fries to its menu. 20 years later, the chain added supersize fries, a serving 3 times larger than what McDonald's offered a generation ago. Supersize fries have 540 calories and 25 grams of fat. At Carl's Jr. restaurants, an order of crisp-cut fries and a double Western bacon cheeseburger boasts 73 grams of fat, more fat than 10 of the chain's milkshakes. A number of attempts to introduce healthy dishes, such as the McLean Deluxe, a hamburger partly composed of seaweed, have proven unsuccessful. A taste for fat developed in childhood is difficult to lose as an adult. At the moment, the fast food industry is heavily promoting menu items that contain bacon. Consumers savor the flavor while operators embrace the profit margin, advertising age noted. A decade ago, restaurants sold about 20% of the bacon consumed in the United States. Now, they sell about 70%. "Make it bacon" is one of the new slogans at McDonald's. With the exception of Subway, which promotes healthier food, the major chains have apparently decided that it's much easier and much more profitable to increase the size and the fat content of their portions than to battle eating habits largely formed by years of their own mass marketing. The cost of America's obesity epidemic extends far beyond emotional pain and low self-esteem. Obesity is now second only to smoking as a cause of mortality in the United States. The CDC estimates that about 280,000 Americans die every year as a direct result of being overweight. The annual health care costs in the United States stemming from obesity now approach $240 billion. On top of that, Americans spend more than $33 billion on various weight loss schemes and diet products. Obesity has been linked to heart disease, colon cancer, stomach cancer, breast cancer, diabetes, arthritis, high blood pressure, infertility, and strokes. A 1999 study by the American Cancer Society found that overweight people had a much higher rate of premature death. Severely overweight people were 4 times more likely to die young than people of normal weight. Moderately overweight people were twice as likely to die young. "The message is, we're too fat and it's killing us," said one of the study's principal authors. Young people who are obese face not only long-term but also immediate threats to their health. Severely obese American children, aged 6 to 10, are now dying from heart attacks caused by their weight. The obesity epidemic that began in the United States during the late 1970s is now spreading to the rest of the world, with fast food as one of its vectors. Between 1984 and 1993, the number of fast food restaurants in Great Britain roughly doubled, and so did the obesity rate among adults. The British now eat more fast food than any other nationality in Western Europe. They also have the highest obesity rate. Obesity is much less of a problem in Italy and Spain, where spending on fast food is relatively low. The relationship between a nation's fast food consumption and its rate of obesity has not been definitively established through any long-term epidemiological study. The growing popularity of fast food is just one of many cultural changes that have been brought about by globalization. Nevertheless, it seems wherever America's fast food chains go, waistlines start expanding. In China, the proportion of overweight teenagers has roughly tripled in the past decade. In Japan, eating hamburgers and French fries has not made people any blonder, though it has made them fatter. Overweight people were once a rarity in Japan. The nation's traditional diet of rice, fish, vegetables, and soy products has been deemed one of the healthiest in the world. And yet, the Japanese are rapidly abandoning that diet. Consumption of red meat has been rising in Japan since the American occupation after World War II. The arrival of McDonald's in 1971 accelerated the shift in Japanese eating habits. During the 1980s, the sale of fast food in Japan more than doubled. The rate of obesity among children soon doubled too. Today, about one-third of all Japanese men in their 30s, members of the nation's first generation raised on Happy Meals and Bigumakus, are overweight. Heart disease, diabetes, colon cancer, and breast cancer, the principal diseases of affluence, have been linked to diets low in fiber and high in animal fats. Long common in the United States, these diseases are likely to become widespread in Japan as its fast food generation ages. More than a decade ago, a study of middle-aged Japanese men who had settled in the United States found that their switch to a Western diet doubled their risk of heart disease and tripled their risk of stroke. For the men in the study, embracing an American way of life meant increasing the likelihood of a premature death. Obesity is extremely difficult to cure. During thousands of years marked by food scarcity, human beings developed efficient physiological mechanisms to store energy as fat. Until recently, societies rarely enjoyed an overabundance of cheap food. As a result, our bodies are far more efficient at gaining weight than losing it. Health officials have concluded that prevention, not treatment, offers the best hope of halting the worldwide obesity epidemic. European consumer groups are pushing for a complete ban on all television advertising directed at children. The eating habits of American kids are now considered a good example of what other countries must avoid. In 1992, Sweden banned all TV advertising directed at children under the age of 12. Ads have been banned from children's television programming in Norway, Belgium, Ireland, and Holland. American children now get about one quarter of their total vegetable servings in the form of potato chips or French fries. A survey of children's advertising in the European Union, EU, found that 95% of the food ads there encourage kids to eat foods high in sugar, salt, and fat. The company running the most ads aimed at children was McDonald's. "Resist America beginning with cola," said a banner at Beijing University in May of 1999. "Attack McDonald's, storm KFC." The U.S. Air Force had just bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, Yugoslavia, and anti-American demonstrations were erupting throughout China. At least a dozen McDonald's and four Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurants were damaged by Chinese protesters. For some reason, no Pizza Huts were harmed. "Maybe they think it's Italian," said a Pizza Hut spokesman in Shanghai. A generation ago, American embassies and oil companies were the most likely targets of overseas demonstrations against U.S. imperialism. Today, fast food restaurants have assumed that symbolic role, with McDonald's a particular favorite. In 1995, a crowd of 400 Danish anarchists looted a McDonald's in downtown Copenhagen, made a bonfire of its furniture in the street, and burned the restaurant to the ground. In 1997, a McDonald's in the Colombian city of Cali was destroyed by a bomb. In 1998, bombs destroyed a McDonald's in St. Petersburg, Russia, two McDonald's in suburban Athens, a McDonald's in the heart of Rio de Janeiro, and a Planet Hollywood in Cape Town, South Africa. In 1999, Belgian vegetarians set fire to a McDonald's in Antwerp. And a year later, May Day protesters tore the sign off a McDonald's in London's Trafalgar Square, destroyed the restaurant, and handed out free hamburgers to the crowd. Fearing more violence, McDonald's temporarily closed all 50 of its London restaurants. In France, a French sheep farmer and political activist named José Bové led a group that demolished a McDonald's under construction in his hometown of Millau. Bové's defiant attitude, brief imprisonment, and impassioned speeches against lousy food have made him a hero in France, praised by socialists and conservatives, invited to meetings with the president and the prime minister. He's written a French bestseller entitled The World Is Not For Sale and Nor Am I. In a society where food is a source of tremendous national pride, the McDonald's Corporation has become an easy target for reasons that are not entirely symbolic. McDonald's is now the largest purchaser of agricultural commodities in France. Bové's message, that Frenchmen should not become servile slaves at the service of agribusiness, has struck a chord. During July of 2000, an estimated 30,000 demonstrators gathered in Millau when José Bové went on trial, some carrying signs that said, "Non à McMerd." The overseas critics of fast food are far more diverse than America's old Soviet bloc adversaries. Farmers, leftists, anarchists, nationalists, environmentalists, consumer advocates, educators, health officials, labor unions, and defenders of animal rights have found common ground in a campaign against the perceived Americanization of the world. Fast food has become a target because it's so ubiquitous, and because it threatens a fundamental aspect of national identity, how, where, and what people choose to eat. Have it your way. Dale Lassiter stands in a corral full of huge bulls, feeding them treats from his hand. Behind him on this warm spring day, the Rockies are still white with snow. Lassiter is in his early 50s, with a handlebar mustache and wire-rimmed glasses. He wears worn-out jeans and boots and a well-ironed button-down shirt, looking part cowboy, part Ivy Leaguer. The bulls that crowd around him seem almost sweet, acting more like a bunch of Ferdinands than like fierce symbols of machismo. They were bred to be gentle, never dehorned, and never roped. The Lassiter Ranch occupies about 30,000 acres of short grass prairie near the town of Matheson, Colorado. It's a profitable working ranch that for half a century has not used pesticides, herbicides, poisons, or commercial fertilizers on the land, has not killed local predators such as coyotes, has not administered growth hormones, anabolic steroids, or antibiotics to the cattle. The Lassiters are by no means typical, but have worked hard to change how American beef is produced. Their philosophy of cattle ranching is based upon a simple tenet: nature is smart as hell. Dale Lassiter's iconoclasm seems bred in the bone. One of his grandfathers headed a Texas Cattlemen's Association during the early 1900s and led the fight against the Beef Trust, testifying before Congress and calling for strict enforcement of the antitrust laws. In retaliation, the Beef Trust refused for years to buy Lassiter cattle. Dale Lassiter's father, Tom, dropped out of Princeton after the Wall Street crash of 1929 to become a full-time rancher. Hard times forced him to seek ways of raising cattle inexpensively. He decided to let nature do most of the work. He bred cattle to be gentle, fertile, and slender and strong, not caring in the least how they looked. He combined Herefords, Shorthorns, and Brahmins to make a whole new breed, only the second new breed of cattle registered in the United States. And he gave the breed an appropriately American name, the Beefmaster. In 1948, Tom Lasseter moved his family from Texas to eastern Colorado. Despite the anger and disbelief of his neighbors, he refused to kill predators or to allow hunting on his land, permitting animals that other ranchers exterminated, rattlesnakes, coyotes, badgers, ground squirrels, gophers, and prairie dogs, to flourish. He thought cattle benefited more from the challenges of a natural ecosystem than from any human efforts to control the environment. Tom Lasseter is 90 years old now, and his memory is failing, but he still has the aura of a strong patriarch. As Dale bounces an old cream-colored Suburban Custom Deluxe along one of the ranch's dirt roads, his father sits in the back seat, wearing a cowboy hat, a bolo tie, and thick black glasses, silently staring at the Beefmasters scattered across the prairie. He scrutinizes them, and every so often asks Dale about a particular animal. The cattle roam a landscape that appears vast and unspoiled. The Lasseter Ranch is a wildlife sanctuary. The native grasses are thriving. Tall cottonwoods grow along the stream banks, and herds of antelope graze alongside the cattle. Dale parks the truck, and I walk a short distance to a rocky outcropping. The Suburban now seems like a small, insignificant speck compared to what surrounds it. Pike's Peak and Cheyenne Mountain rise to the west, and in every other direction, the prairie extends to the horizon, the short grass moving in waves blown by a steady wind. Beyond the Lasseter property line, the land is not faring so well. Smaller farms and ranches in the area have been disappearing for years. A population loss that began in the 1950s has recently slowed, but too late. Many small towns have become virtual ghost towns. In the little commercial district of Matheson, along a dirt road named Broadway, the feed store, the general store, and a repair shop have all been abandoned. The whitewashed buildings have quaint, fading signs and stand empty. The large brick elementary school that Dale Lasseter attended, built at the turn of the century, its architecture full of American optimism, is now used by a local rancher to store grain. Before taking over the family ranch, Dale Lasseter spent a year in Argentina as a Fulbright scholar, ran a feedlot company in Kansas, and managed cattle ranches in Texas, Florida, and New Mexico. He's come to believe that our industrialized system of cattle production cannot be sustained. Rising grain prices may someday hit ranchers and feedlots hard. More importantly, Lasseter finds it hard to justify feeding millions of tons of precious grain to American cattle while elsewhere in the world, millions of people starve. He respects the decision to become a vegetarian, but has little tolerance for the air of moral superiority that often accompanies it. Growing up on the prairie gave him a view of Mother Nature that is somewhat different from the Disney version. Cattle that are not eaten by people, that are simply allowed to grow old and weak, still get eaten by coyotes and turkey buzzards, and it's not a pretty sight. Dale Lasseter recently set up a company to sell organic, free-range, grass-fed beef. None of the cattle used in Lasseter Grasslands beef spent any time at a feedlot. The meat is much lower in fat than grain-fed beef, and has a much stronger, more distinctive flavor. Lasseter says that most Americans have forgotten what real beef tastes like. Argentine beef is considered a gourmet item, served at expensive restaurants, and almost all of the cattle in Argentina are grass-fed. Recent findings that grass-fed cattle may be less likely to spread E. coli 0157H7 have strengthened Lasseter's determination to follow a different path. Along with a number of other innovative ranchers in Colorado, He's trying to raise cattle in a way that does not harm consumers or the land. Hank was a dear friend of his, in many ways a kindred spirit. Lassiter doesn't think that his little company will revolutionize the American beef industry, but it's a start. 60 miles away, on South Nevada Avenue in Colorado Springs, Rich Conway helps run a family business that's also bucking the tide. Conway's Red Top Restaurant occupies a modest brick building on a street full of old Western motels, the kind with animated neon Indian chiefs on their signs, the kind where the U in the 4U motel is a golden horseshoe. Rich Conway's been through a lot. He's had a motorcycle accident and a bad car accident, later slipped on some ice and broke his back. Now in his early 50s, Conway walks slowly with a cane but has a handsome weathered face, a zen-like calm, and a tough independent streak that keeps him going against the odds. He's a survivor. When I asked why the Conway family provides health insurance to all the full-time workers at the restaurant, he smiled politely as though the answer was pretty obvious and said, "We want to have healthy employees." Rich Conway's parents started working at the Red Top not long after it opened in 1944 and bought the restaurant in 1961. He grew up working there, along with his 9 brothers and sisters. Conway's Red Top, with a little spinning top on its yellow sign, became a local favorite thanks to its large oval hamburgers, homemade fries, and friendly atmosphere. The restaurant continued to thrive in the 1970s, despite an invasion by national fast food chains that landed up and down South Nevada. But Conway's almost closed in the early 1980s, after the death of Rich's father. The restaurant's local suppliers helped keep it afloat until new financing could be arranged, a story whose details bring to mind It's a Wonderful Life. Conway's Red Top now has 4 locations in Colorado Springs. Rich Conway was president of the family business until 1999. His younger brother Jim now has that job. Their brother Dan is the finance director. Their sister Mary Kay is the marketing director. Another brother Mike is the operations manager. Another sister, Patty Jo, is an assistant manager. And many of the 37 Conways in the next generation work at various Red Top restaurants. The family has an intense personal commitment to their work, and it shows. According to food critics Jane and Michael Stern, Conway's Red Top sells some of the best hamburgers in the United States. At the Conway's on South Nevada, hamburger patties are still formed every day by hand using fresh, not frozen, ground beef. The meat is obtained from GNC Packing, a small independent processor in Colorado Springs. The buns come from a bakery in Pueblo. 200 pounds of potatoes are peeled every morning in the kitchen and then sliced with an old crank-operated contraption. The burgers and fries are made to order by cooks who earn $10 an hour. They wear baseball caps that say, "Conway's Red Top, one's a meal." The workers are not told what to do by fancy computer software. There's takeout, but no drive-through. And the food is only slightly more expensive than what's served in the half-empty Wendy's across the street. One day, I met a customer at Conway's who has regularly been having lunch there for 50 years. The Conway family is now debating how to expand the business without compromising the values responsible for its success. Opening new restaurants could provide financial opportunities for the dozens of Conway offspring, but could also involve a good deal of risk. The timing may be right, however, for a few more Red Tops to open. As the rest of Colorado grows more bland and homogeneous, Colorado Springs seems to be getting more independent and open-minded. The quirkiness of the downtown may indeed overcome the uniformity of the outlying sprawl. In the 1999 Colorado Springs mayoral race, Mary Lou Makepeace, a single mother with a fine surname for consensus building, was elected to a second term, soundly defeating a right-wing candidate backed by Focus on the Family. Mayor Makepeace had helped persuade the voters of Colorado Springs, perhaps the nation's most Republican city, to vote for a tax increase. The additional revenue was used to protect open land from development. She has also spearheaded new investment in public parks. And she has helped launch the redevelopment of 58 acres of land near the downtown business district, an area that was once a thriving neighborhood but has been largely abandoned for years. The project embraces the goals of the new urbanism, a movement opposed to mindless sprawl, combining residential buildings with commercial and retail space in a way that encourages walking and discourages driving. The aim of the Lowell neighborhood is not to get rid of cars, says architect Maury Bean, but to put them in their proper place, preferably out of sight in underground parking lots. It may be tempting to dismiss Conway's Red Top as a holdover from an earlier era, a business whose low-tech methods are quaint but obsolete. And yet, one of America's most profitable fast food chains operates much like Conway's. In 1948, the year that the McDonald brothers introduced the speedy service system, Harry and Esther Snyder opened their first In-N-Out Burger restaurant on the road between Los Angeles and Palm Springs. It was the nation's first drive-through hamburger stand. Today, there are about 150 In-N-Outs in California and Nevada, generating more than $150 million in annual revenues. Harry Snyder died in 1976, but at the age of 80, Esther still serves as president of the family-owned company. The Snyders have declined countless offers to sell the chain, refused to franchise it, and have succeeded by rejecting just about everything the rest of the fast food industry has done. In-N-Out has followed its own path. There are verses from the Bible on the bottom of its soda cups. More importantly, the chain pays the highest wages in the fast food industry. The starting wage of a part-time worker at In-N-Out is $8 an hour. Full-time workers get a benefits package that includes medical, dental, vision, and life insurance. The typical salary of an In-N-Out restaurant manager is more than $80,000 a year. The managers have, on average, been with the chain for more than 13 years. The high wages at In-N-Out have not led to higher prices or lower quality food. The most expensive item on the menu costs $2.45. There are no microwaves, heat lamps, or freezers in the kitchens at In-N-Out restaurants. The ground beef is fresh. Potatoes are peeled every day to make the fries, and the milkshakes are made from ice cream, not syrup. In March of 2000, the annual Restaurants and Institutions Choice in Chains survey found that among the nation's fast food hamburger chains, In-N-Out ranked first in food quality, value, service, atmosphere, and cleanliness. In-N-Out has ranked highest in food quality every year that the chain has been included in the survey. According to the consumers polled by Restaurants and Institutions in 2000, the lowest quality food of any major hamburger chain was served at McDonald's. There's nothing inevitable about the fast food nation that surrounds us, about its marketing strategies, labor policies, and agricultural techniques, about its relentless drive for conformity and cheapness. The triumph of McDonald's and its imitators was by no means preordained. During the past two decades, rhetoric about the free market has cloaked changes in the nation's economy bear little relation to real competition or freedom of choice. From the airline industry to the publishing business, from the railroads to telecommunications, American corporations have worked hard to avoid the rigors of the market by eliminating and absorbing their rivals. The strongest engines of American economic growth in the 1990s, the computer, software, aerospace, and satellite industries, have been heavily subsidized by the Pentagon for decades. Indeed, the U.S. defense budget has long served as a form of industrial policy, a quasi-socialist system of planning that frequently yields unplanned results. The Internet, at the heart of today's new economy, began as the ARPANET, a military communications network created in the late 1970s. For better or worse, legislation passed by Congress has played a far more important role in shaping the economic history of the post-war era than any free market forces. The market is a tool and a useful one, but the worship of this tool is a hollow faith. Far more important than any tool is what you make with it. Many of America's greatest accomplishments stand in complete defiance of the free market, the prohibition of child labor, the establishment of a minimum wage, the creation of wilderness areas and national parks, the construction of dams, bridges, roads, churches, schools, and universities. If all that mattered were the unfettered right to buy and sell, tainted food could not be kept off supermarket shelves, toxic waste could be dumped next door to elementary schools, and every American family could import an indentured servant or two, paying them with meals instead of money. Much like the workings of the market, technology is just one means toward an end, not something to be celebrated for its own sake. The Titan II missiles built at the Lockheed Martin plant northwest of Colorado Springs were originally designed to carry nuclear warheads. Today, they carry weather satellites into orbit. The missiles are equally efficient at both tasks. There is nothing inexorable about the use of such technology. Its value cannot be judged without considering its purpose and likely effects. The launch of a Titan II can be beautiful or horrific, depending upon the aim of the missile and what it carries. No society in human history worshipped science more devoutly or more blindly than the Soviet Union, where scientific socialism was considered the highest truth. And no society has ever suffered so much environmental devastation on such a massive scale. The history of the 20th century was dominated by the struggle against totalitarian systems of state power. The 21st will no doubt be marked by a struggle to curtail excessive corporate power. The great challenge now facing countries throughout the world is how to find a proper balance between the efficiency and the amorality of the market. Over the past 20 years, the United States has swung too far in one direction, weakening the regulations that safeguard workers, consumers, and the environment. An economic system promising freedom has too often become a means of denying it, as the narrow dictates of the market gain precedence over more important democratic values. Today's fast food industry is the culmination of those larger social and economic trends. The low price of a fast food hamburger does not reflect its real cost, and should. The profits of the fast food chains have been made possible by losses imposed on the rest of society. The annual cost of obesity alone is now twice as large as the fast food industry's total revenues. The environmental movement has forced companies to curtail their pollution, and a similar campaign must induce the fast food chains to assume responsibility for their business practices and minimize their harmful effects. In 1995, the American Academy of Pediatrics declared that advertising directed at children is inherently deceptive and exploits children under 8 years of age. The Academy did not recommend a ban on such advertising because it seemed impractical and would infringe upon advertisers' freedom of speech. Today, the health risks faced by the nation's children far outweigh the needs of its mass marketers. Congress should immediately ban all advertisements aimed at children that promote foods high in fat and sugar. 30 years ago, Congress banned cigarette ads from radio and television as a public health measure, and those ads were directed at adults. Smoking has declined ever since. A ban on advertising unhealthy foods to children would discourage eating habits that are not only hard to break, but potentially life-threatening. Moreover, such a ban would encourage the fast food chains to alter the recipes for their children's meals. Greatly reducing the fat content of Happy Meals, for example, could have an immediate effect on the diet of the nation's kids. Every month, more than 90% of the children in the United States eat at McDonald's. Congress cannot require fast food chains to provide job training to their workers, but it can eliminate the tax breaks that reward chains for churning through their workers and keeping job skills to a minimum. Job training schemes subsidized by the federal government should insist that companies employ workers for at least a year and actually provide some training. Strict enforcement of minimum wage, overtime, and child labor laws would improve the lives of fast food workers, as would OSHA regulations on workplace violence at restaurants. Passing new laws to facilitate union organizing might not lead to picket lines in front of every McDonald's, but it would encourage the fast food industry to treat workers better and listen to their complaints. Teenagers should be rewarded, not harmed, by the decision to work after school. And if the nation is genuinely interested in their future, it'll adequately fund their education instead of inviting advertisers into the schools. As for the food now served at school cafeterias, it should be safer to eat than what is sold at fast food restaurants, not less safe. The USDA should insist upon the highest possible food safety standards from every company that supplies ground beef to the school lunch program, or it should stop purchasing ground beef. American taxpayers shouldn't be paying for food that might endanger their children. The USDA's recent decision to perform E. coli 0157H7 tests on the ground beef it buys for schools, though commendable, was made more than 7 years after the Jack in the Box outbreak. It was made after countless children were needlessly sickened. The meatpacking industry's ability to sell questionable meat for years to the federal agency responsible for ensuring safe food is just one more symptom of a much broader problem of a government food safety system that's poorly structured, underfunded, and unable to detect most outbreaks of food poisoning. Federal officials and meatpacking executives often claim that the United States has the safest food supply in the world. There is little evidence to support that contention. Other countries have enacted much tougher food safety laws and implemented much more thorough food inspection systems. Sweden began a program to eliminate salmonella from its livestock more than 40 years ago. At Dutch slaughterhouses, the speed of the production line is determined by food safety considerations. At the moment, a dozen federal agencies in the United States are responsible for food safety, and 28 congressional committees oversee them. The welter of competing bureaucracies leads to confusion, gaps in enforcement, and numerous food safety absurdities. The USDA has the power to conduct microbial tests on cattle that have already been slaughtered, but cannot test live cattle in order to keep infected animals out of slaughterhouses. The manufacture of frozen cheese pizzas is regulated by the FDA. But if a pizza has pepperoni on it, the USDA has food safety jurisdiction. Eggs are regulated by the FDA, but chickens are regulated by the USDA. And a lack of cooperation between the two agencies has hampered efforts to reduce the levels of salmonella in American eggs. Salmonella has been almost entirely eliminated from Swedish and Dutch eggs. Every year in the United States, however, more than 500,000 people become ill after eating eggs contaminated with salmonella, and more than 300 people die. Congress should create a single food safety agency that has sufficient authority to protect the public health. The two main tasks currently assigned to the USDA to promote American agriculture and to police it are incompatible. The nation's other leading food safety agency, the FDA, spends much of its budget regulating prescription drugs. An American food processor can expect a visit from an FDA inspector on average once every 10 years. The new food safety agency should be given the power to track commodities throughout the production cycle, from their origin on ranches and farms to their sale at restaurants and supermarkets. At the moment, the nation's roughly 200,000 fast food restaurants are not subject to any oversight by federal health authorities. The war on foodborne pathogens deserves the sort of national attention and resources that has been devoted to the war on drugs. Far more Americans are severely harmed every year by food poisoning than by illegal drug use. And the harms caused by food poisoning are usually inadvertent and unanticipated. People who smoke crack know the potential dangers, Most people who eat hamburgers don't. Eating in the United States should no longer be a form of high-risk behavior. The steps taken to improve sanitary conditions at the nation's slaughterhouses can have the added benefit of lowering the injury rate among meatpacking workers. The line speeds at Dutch slaughterhouses average less than 100 cattle an hour. The American average is more than three times as high. IBP workers that I met in Lexington, Nebraska, told me that they always liked days when their plant was processing beef for shipment to the European Union, which imposes tough standards on imported meat. They said IBP slowed down the line so that work could be performed more carefully. The IBP workers liked EU days because the pace was less frantic and there were fewer injuries. The working conditions and food safety standards in the nation's meatpacking plants should not improve on days when the beef is being processed for export. American workers and consumers deserve at least the same consideration as overseas customers. Toughening the food safety laws could also reduce the number of slaughterhouse workers who get hurt. The greatest gains in workers' safety, however, will come when state and federal authorities look at the meatpacking industry's injury rate from a new perspective. Almost any workplace injury viewed in isolation can be described as an accident. Workers are routinely made to feel responsible for their own injuries, and many do indeed make mistakes. But when at least one-third of meatpacking workers are injured every year, when the causes of those injuries are well known, when the means to prevent those injuries are readily available and yet not applied, there is nothing accidental about the lacerations, amputations, cumulative traumas, and deaths in the meatpacking industry. These injuries do not stem from individual mistakes. They are systematic, and they are caused by greed. OSHA fines imposed on meatpacking companies have done little to change the safety practices of the industry. At the moment, the maximum OSHA fine for a death caused by willful employer negligence is $70,000. That amount does not strike fear in the hearts of agribusiness executives, whose firms annually earn tens of billions of dollars. Much tougher sanctions should be imposed on behalf of the thousands of meatpacking workers who are needlessly injured each year. These injuries are by no means impossible to foresee or prevent. The new penalties should include greatly increased OSHA fines, mandatory plant closures, and criminal charges for negligence. The prosecution of a few meatpacking executives for the deaths or injuries of their workers will serve as a wake-up call for the industry. It will convey a blunt message that most Americans would instinctively support. Allowing innocent people to be maimed and killed is a crime. The working conditions in America's slaughterhouses demonstrate what can happen when employers wield virtually unchecked power over their workers. When labor unions have too much influence, they can become corrupt and encourage inefficiencies. But the absence of unions can permit corporations to behave like continuing criminal enterprises, to violate labor laws with impunity. If the meatpacking industry is allowed the continuing recruitment of poor, illiterate, often illegal immigrants, many other industries will soon follow its example. The rise of a migrant industrial workforce poses a grave threat to democracy. Workers who are illegal immigrants cannot vote and have little ability to defend their legal rights. Without the countervailing force of labor unions, companies will increasingly seek out and exploit the most vulnerable members of society. As in the meatpacking industry, the progress made by American workers over the course of a century will literally vanish overnight. The rural ghettos of Lexington and Greeley should not represent the future of America's heartland. Any reform of the current system of industrialized agriculture will have to address the needs of independent ranchers and farmers. They're more than just a sentimental link to America's rural past. They are a unique source of innovation and long-term stewardship of the land. Throughout the Cold War, America's decentralized system of agriculture, relying upon millions of independent producers, was depicted as the most productive system in the world, as proof of capitalism's inherent superiority. The perennial crop failures in the Soviet Union were attributed to a highly centralized system run by distant bureaucrats. Today, the handful of agribusiness firms that dominate American food production are championing another centralized system of production, one in which livestock and farmland are viewed purely as commodities. Farmers are reduced to the status of employees, and crop decisions are made by executives far away from the fields. Although competition between the large processors has indeed led to lower costs for consumers, price fixing and collusion have devastated independent ranchers and farmers. The antitrust laws outlawing such behavior need to be vigorously enforced. More than a century ago, during the congressional debate on the Sherman Antitrust Act, Henry M. Teller, a Republican senator from Colorado, dismissed the argument that lower consumer prices justified the ruthless exercise of monopoly power. "I do not believe," Teller argued, "that the great object in life is to make everything cheap." Having centralized American agriculture, the large agribusiness firms are now attempting, like Soviet commissars, to stifle criticism of their policies. Over the past decade, veggie libel laws backed by agribusiness have been passed in 13 states. The laws make it illegal to criticize agricultural commodities in a manner inconsistent with reasonable scientific evidence. The whole concept of veggie libel is probably unconstitutional. Nevertheless, these laws remain on the books. Oprah Winfrey, among others, has been sued for making disparaging remarks about food. In Texas, a man was sued by a sod company for criticizing the quality of its lawns. In Georgia and Alabama, the veggie libel laws have been framed in imitation of British libel law, placing the burden of proof upon the defendant. In Colorado, violating the veggie libel law is now a criminal, not a civil offense. Criticizing the ground beef produced at the Greeley slaughterhouse could put you behind bars. Congress should ban advertising that preys upon children. It should stop subsidizing dead-end jobs. It should pass tougher food safety laws. It should protect American workers from serious harm. It should fight against dangerous concentrations of economic power. Congress should do all those things, but it isn't likely to do any of them soon. The political influence of the fast food industry and its agribusiness suppliers makes a discussion of what Congress should do largely academic. The fast food industry spends millions of dollars every year on lobbying and billions on mass marketing. The wealth and power of the major chains make them seem impossible to defeat. And yet, those companies must obey the demands of one group, consumers, whom they eagerly flatter and pursue. As market for fast food in the United States becomes increasingly saturated, the chains have to compete fiercely with one another for customers. According to William P. Foley II, the chairman of the company that owns Carl's Jr., the basic imperative of today's fast food industry is grow or die. The slightest drop in a chain's market share can cause a large decline in the value of its stock. Even the McDonald's Corporation is now vulnerable to the changing whims of consumers. It is opening fewer McDonald's in the United States and expanding mainly through pizza, chicken, and Mexican food chains that do not bear the company name. The right pressure applied to the fast food industry in the right way could produce change faster than any act of Congress. The United Students Against Sweatshops and other activist groups have brought widespread attention to the child labor, low wages, and hazardous working conditions in Asian factories that make sneakers for Nike. At first, the company disavowed responsibility for these plants, which it claimed were owned by independent suppliers. Nike later changed course, forcing its Asian suppliers to improve working conditions and pay higher wages. The same tactics employed by the anti-sweatshop groups can be used to help workers much closer to home, workers in the slaughterhouses and processing plants of the High Plains. As the nation's largest purchaser of beef, the McDonald's Corporation must be held accountable for the behavior of its suppliers. When McDonald's demanded ground beef free of lethal pathogens, the five companies that manufacture its hamburger patties increased their investment in new equipment and microbial testing. If McDonald's were to demand higher wages and safer working conditions for meatpacking workers, its suppliers would provide them. As the nation's largest purchaser of potatoes, McDonald's could also use its clout on behalf of Idaho farmers. And as the second largest purchaser of chicken, McDonald's could demand changes in the way poultry growers are compensated by their processors. Small increases in the cost of beef, chicken, and potatoes would raise fast food menu prices by a few pennies, if at all. The fast food chains insist that suppliers follow strict specifications regarding the sugar content, fat content, size, shape, taste, and texture of their products. The chains could just as easily enforce a strict code of conduct governing the treatment of workers, ranchers, and farmers. McDonald's has already shown a willingness to act quickly when confronted with consumer protests. In the late 1960s, African-American groups attacked McDonald's Corporation for opening restaurants in minority neighborhoods without giving minority businessmen the opportunity to become franchisees. The company responded by actively recruiting African-American franchisees, a move that diffused tensions and helped McDonald's penetrate urban markets. A decade ago, environmentalists criticized the chain for the amount of polystyrene waste it generated. At the time, McDonald's served hamburgers in little plastic boxes that were briefly used and then discarded, making it one of the nation's largest purchasers of polystyrene. In order to counter the criticism, McDonald's formed an unusual alliance with the Environmental Defense Fund in August of 1990 and later announced that the chain's hamburgers would no longer be served in polystyrene boxes. The decision was portrayed in the media as the greening of McDonald's and a great victory for the environmental movement. The switch from plastic boxes to paper ones did not, however, represent a sudden and profound change in corporate philosophy. It was a response to bad publicity. McDonald's no longer uses polystyrene boxes in the United States, but it continues to use them overseas, where the environmental harms are no different. Even the anticipation of consumer anger has prompted McDonald's to demand changes from its suppliers. In the spring of 2000, McDonald's informed Lamb Weston and the J.R. Simplot Company that it would no longer purchase frozen French fries made from genetically engineered potatoes. As a result, the two large processors told their growers to stop planting genetically engineered potatoes, and sales of Monsanto's New Leaf, the nation's only biotech potato, instantly plummeted. McDonald's had stopped serving genetically engineered potatoes a year earlier in Western Europe, where the issue of Frankenfoods had generated enormous publicity. In the United States, there was relatively little consumer backlash against genetic engineering. Nevertheless, McDonald's decided to act. Just the fear of controversy swiftly led to a purchasing change with important ramifications for American agriculture. Nobody in the United States is forced to buy fast food. The first step toward meaningful change is by far the easiest. Stop buying it. The executives who run the fast food industry are not bad men. They are businessmen. They will sell free-range, organic, grass-fed hamburgers if you demand it. They will sell whatever sells at a profit. The usefulness of the market, its effectiveness as a tool, cuts both ways. The real power of the American consumer has not yet been unleashed. The heads of Burger King, KFC, and McDonald's should feel daunted. They're outnumbered. There are three of them and almost 300 million of you. A good boycott, a refusal to buy, can speak much louder than words. Sometimes the most irresistible force is the most mundane. Pull open the glass door. Feel the rush of cool air. Walk inside, get in line, and look around you. Look at the kids working in the kitchen, at the customers in their seats, at the ads for the latest toys. Study the backlit color photographs above the counter. Think about where the food came from, about how and where it was made, about what is set in motion by every single fast food purchase, the ripple effect near and far. Think about it. Then place your order, or turn and walk out the door. It's not too late. Even in this fast food nation, you can still have it your way. This is Rick Adamson. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Fast Food Nation by Eric Schlosser. This program was produced and directed by Paul Rubin. Abridgment by Lynn Lauber.